This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress, and I am with my favorite poet today, Joel Diaz Porter, whom I knew as DJ Renegade, and we'll call him Renegade maybe, and he's going to read us a poem.
In her hands, his wedding band, slant rain. Albeit for GS, only because it was a Thursday, which is her Monday. And I thought she was walking as though hauling something heavy, yet not in her hands. And maybe I saw her sigh, so I recalled Lonnie, who you might not know. Not Lonnie, who was always pawning his wedding band so he could feed the penny slots, or Lonnie from the Hill, who always seemed to be half a slice short of a sandwich. But Lonnie from Lonnie's Lament. And here she cocks her head and wrinkles her nose, saying, who? Because whatever could slant his reins so sideways, perhaps allowed Coltrane to raise a sax to his lips and blow a lamentation as her Monday motion. A wistful wisp of piano, nearly legato as her legs, or a baseline of hair that plunges when she brushes it into a black Niagara, which she can't know, may convince me I could spend the rest of my days naked and trembling in a maple barrel, falling forever into its obsidian mist.
One of my favorites from your new book. Tell us the title of this new book, which is premiering today.
It's Ideas of Improvisation.
Yes. And how long in the making?
Some of the poems in this manuscript are 25 years old.
So. Are there any repeat poems from former publications?
Yes. About, I think, maybe a third of the poems in the book have been previously published.
Diaz Porter, I read this book, and you actually picked out one of my favorite poems there to begin with. But test my memory. The first book, was it a green cover?
No, it was black and light blue, actually.
Well, see, I was close, right? Oh, and did it have something to do with a diamond? Was there a diamond in the title?
There was 4,000 Shades of Blue.
That's the one. See, I made it. Bingo. I was right on both counts. But that is the first book that you had?
Yeah, it was kind of a chapbook, but yeah. That was in the late, mid-90s.
Gee, it seemed like there was something before then that was green, but I won't fight with you about that. But we met years ago, and it could have been with Kenny Carroll and Brian Gilmore.
Kenny Carroll.
The three men in my life. And it was at WPFW, an all jazz station. You just blew the place apart. You were so shy, DJ Renegade. You were so shy. And when you spoke, it was like Miles Davis. I swear, your poetry was like Miles Davis. You have a lot of music in your poems. And you are almost a jazz scholar.
I wouldn't go that far, but I'm a lover of jazz, certainly.
I go far. If you're with me, I go very far. But talk about the DJ part of you, because when you were a young man, that was your profession.
Yeah. For 15 years, I was a nightclub DJ.
And what was it called when they stopped and started real fast? I used to know. And you would cut it and then start and stop the record really fast.
What was that? Like cutting and scratching that's what we call it, cutting and scratching, yeah.
It was a work of art, wasn't it?
Yes, it still is, yeah. It's like playing an instrument almost.
Talk about that, how your sensibilities stay tuned for exactly when to do that. That's all intuition, right?
Not all intuition. Some of it is planned, like, what parts of the record you want to repeat. And how you want to repeat it. And then some of it is improvisation. Like, if you're doing what they call beat rocking, sometimes, you might do it a little different one time, a little different another time. So that part of it is very much like playing an instrument. And then also, if you're a really good DJ, you're watching the crowd and you're seeing how they respond. And so your decision of how long to hold a section or where to go, which part of the song to go to next is based on what you think the crowd needs in that moment.
Do you see that I am just beaming to be with you again after 20 years? And I'm going to just say one more thing, and you can say no. His IQ exceeds 200, and everyone knows. Yes, it does. Everybody knows this. You could have been the chess champion. of America, if you wished to go in that direction. You were like a wild chess player, and your mind is an encyclopedia of math, so that poetry must sort of balance the left and the right brain, right? And keep you standing up.
I think it does. I think it does.
Let's hear a poem from Joel Diaz Porter, who I will always call DJ Renegade.
Okay, this poem, let me say real quick, one of the unusual things about my book is that the text is in two colors. And so all of the black text forms the base poems. And then some of the text is maroon. And so the words that are highlighted in maroon form separate poems on top of or inside the other poems. I call them polypoems. And most of those, the shorter polypoems, the maroon poems, are Japanese short forms, so they're haiku or senryu or tanka. So in the previous poem, the first three lines that I did, those were the maroon text. So I'll start this poem with the maroon text, and then I'll read the title and the rest of the poem. The sound of praying, which is our cracked window. El Magnifico. Who am I? I am a small point in the eye of the full moon. I need only one ray of the sun to warm my face. I need only one breeze from the trade winds to refresh my soul. What else can I ask if I know that my sons really love me? Roberto Clemente. Even under a heavy quilt, there's a breeze from a distant transistor radio. My lips mimic a slice of honeydew as they remember it's New Year's Day, the last before heading back to school. Straining to hear the broadcast above my brother Jeff snoring in the bunk below, I roll over. The regular program has been interrupted by the sound of waves washing against the shore, which I pretend is not my mother praying. It's January in Pittsburgh, which is to say the radiator shudders against what howls outside our cracked window. After hopping down on the cold linoleum and tiptoeing to Mama's bedroom door, I cup one ear to the plies of wood. The radio reports that a plane flying Roberto Clemente food and clothing to earthquake victims in Nicaragua is missing off the coast of San Juan. No bodies have been found, only debris floating in the waves. The words hit my chest like the fat end of a bat. I collapse at the base of the door until my mother cracks it, her own eyes raw, and picks me up, rocking slowly. A glove left in the Little League grass is all I knew of loss. Even though a stadium shouting, "Arriba, Roberto," was all I knew of Espanol, didn't I fall asleep most nights pretending he was my father? In our world of chipped asphalt and falling bricks, his John Henry swagger was perhaps all I knew of myth. Hadn't I taken a black crayon and drawn the number 21 on the back of a t-shirt, then raced to play right field because his glove upturned for a basket catch was all I knew of grace. Brown as spiced rum, blacker than barges of coal, he somehow covered the gap between Puerto Rico's cane fields and our three rivers. Dark smoke choked the sun. Our city of rusty bridges and rolling hills began to lose the glow from its fabled mills. While on a rocky Puerto Rican shore, his family gathered to him as waves peeped into shark's teeth and the arms of palm trees swayed. Adios, Roberto.
The voice of Joel Diaz Porter from his new book. Give us the title of the book again.
It's Ideas of Improvisation on Thread Makes Blanket Press.
He was the 1998 and 1999 Haiku Slam champion, and his poems have been published in dozens of great magazines and anthologies in America. He was a Cave Canem Fellow and received the Furious Flower Emerging Poet Award. And this book is just coming out from Thread Makes Blanket Press. So you say it's been 30 years in the making. I remember a couple of those poems that I read from your manuscript, but if someone says to you, what are the themes in this book, how would you answer that? It's so full of passion and tone. Are there themes?
I think there are themes. I think one of them is... the idea of seeking, whether, it's for love or knowledge or beauty or mystery, I do think that seeking is a theme that runs through the poem. I consider myself, I don't know if this is true or not, but I consider myself to be part of a tradition of radical love poetry, mystical poetry, like Sufi poets, you know, like Hafez and Rumi and Kabir. So I do feel like the title of the book, Ideas of Improvisation, one of the themes that kind of runs through there is that, you know, as we go through our lives, we're constantly improvising, trying to find harmony with nature. And the seeking is part of that improvisation.
There you have it. Okay. Because for you, there is a Zen quality. When you take the haiku, it's interesting that you chose a form that is so mystical, and that you chose a form that must take noticing. It must take a diamond-like precision. It's very prismatic, and it's very Buddhist. So, I mean, Pittsburgh, look what you've done. Pittsburgh to Buddhism. But do you have a huge spiritual life. Can you talk about that? I mean, it's not one you parade around. Is it just in your poetry that you notice everything and they cherish everything, that you treasure everything, and then you make it permanent?
I wouldn't say it's just, I mean, poetry is very much a spiritual practice for me. It's very much a meditative practice for me, whether that's writing it or reading it or performing it. I am a non-theist, so I don't necessarily believe in the idea of, you know, like a deity that's outside of us that controls the world or you know, dictates how things happen. But I do think the idea of spirituality, a greater community, a greater unitedness is a very important thing. Although I think of spirituality more as a human emotion. So I do think that, you know, that's a very important thing. So, you know, whether I'm meditating, you know, whether I'm writing haiku, which again, haiku is a very Zen kind of thing. And I think that Zen is perhaps an optimal process for the operation of the human brain. So it's a very good way of going through life. And again, you know, improvisation is kind of an important part in Zen, because Zen is about being in the moment and, you know, reacting and dealing, responding to things that you see in the moment.
Well, read us some more. Joel Diaz Porter.
We're talking about a haiku. I'll share a few. So these are some of the poems that are in maroon text that are formed on top of other poems. So, for example, there's a series of poems in the book that are titled An Idea of Improvisation, and then the last part of it varies. So, for example, from An Idea of Improvisation at 33 and a third RPMs, we'll find the poem, The Lover's Tongue's Dream of Rhyme. From Wednesday poem, Desire, the Wild Iris Inside. From an Idea of Improvisation on Liberty Breer, Late Sunlight, Crow's Wings Darken the Daisies. And then there's the Idea of Improvisation in Flight, April Winds, The Evening News, Lilacs. From a poem called Algorithm of the Blues, Birdsong, Even the Moon Takes Notes.
Do you write the haiku first and then frame the poem around it? How does that happen?
No. Actually, what happened was the manuscript was finished, and I had this idea, you know, like people do erasure poems.
Yes.
Where they take a text and then they erase the text. So I was like, well, what if I did kind of took that idea, but instead of using a foreign text, I used my own poems. And instead of erasing the poem underneath, I uplift or highlight certain words in the poem. And so that became, you know, like this kind of improvisatory process where I would go through the poems and try to see. And because I write haiku, I was like, let me see if I can find a haiku within the poem. And so I started playing around with that idea.
So you had the whole poem. And because the poem always has the same tone, and everything is from you, and you are the source of all the words, then there must be words that track. So that is a new form. We have to call that a form, like Terrence Hayes's Golden Shovel, you know, a form. We have to call that a new form, because we need to teach that. Because if a poet is true to his diction, then there should be language in there that stands alone. So shall it be, what would you like us to call this for immortality? The Joel Diaz Porter shovel, or the renegade? No, what should we do? The renegade haiku.
You know, I've been calling them ghost poems, but.
Oh, that's okay. Ghost poems. That's what they're going to be. My favorite is The Wild Iris Inside.
Ah.
That says it all, doesn't it? Well, I don't think people are surprised that within your poems that are energetic and passionate and sometimes rap-like, there is the spiritual, the haiku in there. Because the first thing I knew about you was your kindness. That's what comes out first about you. So we would like to hear more poetry.
Okay, well, one of the things that's a little bit unusual about this manuscript, there's this haiku that I improvised out of the poems, but then there's also a haiku that I just wrote, you know, because I am a haiku poet. And some of those haiku are in the language of Portuguese Creole, which is from the Cape Verde Islands, which is where my family is from on my mother's side. And so as far as I know, no one else has published any haiku in Creole. It's been a dream of mine for many, 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 many years. And so in this manuscript, there's 7 haiku. I don't know how good they are, but the 7 haiku that I wrote, and these were written originally in Creole and then translated into English. And so I'd like to share a few of those.
All of them.
So this one is I'll read them in Creole first. Cancha na bureja, mesmo que mar, saudade de mar. Conch to your ear. Even at the ocean, longing for the ocean. Chora de gongon. Gongon is a bird, a seabird that is commonly found on the island of Fogo, which is where my people are from. There's 10 islands in the archipelago of Cape Verde. 9 of them are inhabited. And one of them, Fogo, which is the Portuguese word for fire, is an active volcano. And my grandfather and grandmother grew up on the side of that volcano, actually. So anyway, the gongon is a seabird that's native to that island. Chora de gongon, tudo razão, ela capô de ouro. Cry of the gongon, every reason she can't hear. And then Cape Verde is famous for a couple of things. One of them is for the beauty of its women. Another is for its music. And the singer Cesaria Evora is probably the most famous Cape Verdean singer around the world. And she's known for a type of indigenous song called Morna, which you could think of as kind of like the blues in Creole. And so this one is Morna, azul de mar, cacima azul de céu. Morna, the blues of the sea are not the blues of the sky. So there's a few.
You know, is the one even at the ocean, longing for the ocean?
Yes.
Is that what it's called? That Basho, back up Basho. Because he has something, every time I see the ocean, my mother, every time. Something, I think it's something like that. But those are up right up there. Those are right up there, those haiku. Were you always able to speak Creole?
No. Actually, it's an interesting thing. My grandparents did not want my mother and her brothers and sisters to learn to speak Creole. Since they were immigrants, they wanted them to learn to speak English. But my grandparents spoke it to each other. They spoke it to their brothers and sisters and the other people in the community. So my mother grew up knowing words, but not necessarily being able to speak it. And so for me, it became a thing that, I'm always interested in language and things like that. So when some of my cousins came over from Cape Verde, I spent a lot of time with them. And so I learned it from them. I got them to teach me, taught myself, however you want to put it. And, eventually, you know, at a certain point, I became fluent.
You became fluent. You are so modest. You know, it's scientifically proven that the mathematical brain that is highly developed can apply itself to language. So don't show off. It just came with your DNA. You have nothing to do with this. Have you ever gone back to the island?
I have not. And it's one of, you know, probably my greatest longings. And so it's a weird thing in my life. But three times I had a chance to go where the trip was paid for. And I just had to go. And every time something happened that prevented me from going. And so I'm hoping to go. The last time actually the thing that stopped me was the pandemic. So I'm hoping to go back. I'd like to go back with my mom, actually.
And your son. Just briefly tell the world what your son does, because it is so 21st century, 22nd century. It is so futuristic. I didn't even know people did this.
Oh, yeah, well, he plays video games for a living. He's an elite Madden player, and he's known as Joel CP. And he's kind of famous in that community.
I'm going to look him up. Joel CP. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
You can look him up on YouTube.
He's got I will. And he is in the major leagues?
He is in the major leagues of Madden, yes.
And he competes and wins, like in chess?
And yeah, they have tournaments.
And he keeps winning?
Well, I mean, you know, you don't always win. Sometimes you place. And as a matter of fact, the majority of times you place, you know, maybe coming third or whatever. But you get money for, you know, for placing as
well.
He's
playing, it's a living, right? It's a profession.
Yeah. And he streams on Twitch and things like that. Yeah.
I will definitely check him out. I don't think I'd recognize him since he was two last I saw him banging on a piano. So, Joel Diaz Porter, take us somewhere else in this beautiful manuscript, because if it doesn't win the Pulitzer, I am protesting.
Well, if it gets listed for any award, I'd be ecstatic. So since we mentioned Rumi and the Sufi tradition, there's a series of poems, another series of poems in the book. That's the Blank in You, where Blank is the name of a famous person. So there's a poem called the Bukowski in You. There's one for the great mathematician Al-Khwarizmi. There's Al-Khwarizmi in You. So this poem is the Rumi in You. So central to faith, wind-blown rain. The Rumi in you stirs to wonder. What bruise could ruin love more than the rasp of eroding rain? When I say rasp, you may think of rust, another type of ruin related to rain. Did you not grasp how Jalaluddin was among the last poets whose nappy beard faced ruin in every nation, including rumination? As one harvest moon acquired a goatee of clouds, didn't you almost admit to whiskering a weak chin as if your own ruined beauty was an unwearable thing? Although you seldom whispered it, wabi-sabi, Japanese for the rain of ruin, could be a Rumi word. When you first heard the flamenco of ruin begin to flower, did you lament or invent a belief in wabi-sabi? Could such belief in lonely bruising begin addiction to the long open you found in womb? Or say why that eye so central to your faith ran quietly as a letter left out in the rain? Perhaps outside some window, you misheard the whirling music of windblown petals whispering, rain in mystery. As you once saw a bruise begin to whisk a thickening rue from a flower's fat sorrow, couldn't your beard have also masqueraded as faith or masculinity, or perhaps even a beloved which blooms through dark whiskers, until you start to hear how some poets become lovers of the sound of rain, but others simply lovers of the sound of ruin?
What are those last two lines again? Some people or poets become lovers?
Some poets become lovers of the sound of rain, but others simply lovers of the sound of ruin.
Mm.
And it's also, the poem is complicated by a famous quote from Rumi, which I don't use as an epigraph, but it could serve as an epigraph. And the quote is, where there is ruin, there's a chance for treasure.
Have you read all of Rumi?
Well, no, I haven't read all of Rumi. I've read a great deal of Rumi. Unfortunately, I cannot read Persian, so you know, I read some of the translations, like Colin Barks has a bunch of translations. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They're good. They're good.
They're their own poems in English. Like when I read paraphrases from Farsi, I mean, you know, it's translating poetry is difficult and you can't always translate things exactly. But one of the things that I do is I go on YouTube and I listen to the Masnavi in Persian. You know, they have recordings of it in Persian. And so I listen to it in Persian, even though I can't understand it, because I, you know, I can still hear the form and I can still hear the rhythm. And sometimes you can hear, you know, little plays on sound and things like that, just to get a sense of the spirit of it. But, you know, if I want to understand the meaning, I either have to look at, translations.
That brings me to a question that was right on the tip of my mind. How much of your life is study and how much comes naturally to you? So I'm hearing that you really research this kind of poetry, but for instance, mathematics, you're just gifted with math. So how much of that was actually academic study in mathematics, or how much of that did you just come with? Poetry, how much of that is researching, and how much of that is a natural gift? So what part of your life is spent in an academic pursuit, and how much, for instance, chess, how long did you study chess, or was it just natural to you?
Well, I think all these things are a combination. And, you know, I'm informally educated. I have no formal education past high school, but I'm also on the spectrum. And so like a lot of autistic people, I have, you know, obsessions, you know, or what they call special interests. And so because of that, I wouldn't really say like there's my life here and there's study over there. You know, I love to learn. And so my life, in a sense, is study, and has always been study. Like I learned how to read when I was 4 from my mom. And, you know, I love to read. And so I'm constantly reading, and I'm constantly, like, you know, nowadays with the internet, falling down rabbit holes. And so, you know, I'll fall down a rabbit hole and then that could be my whole day. You know, I'll be looking up, you know, the sex life of, you know, grackles in Southern Eurasia or whatever. I mean, whatever it happens to be. Now, to answer the other part of your question, I do think there are certain things that, you know, that are, how do I put it, that my brain is better at intuitively. And part of that is, you know, part of that is due to me being autistic, for example. I have the ability.
Oh, please. You push it away as if it's a compensation or a handicap.
I'm saying certain things, like, for example, the ability to find patterns, you know, and things that other people might not be able to find, for example. Now, they give you one example. I played the trumpet when I was a kid and in high school. But one of the things that I realized was that I was okay, I was pretty good, but the people that were better than me, they seemed to understand music as a language, just like naturally. So like I could understand a piece of music as like a beautiful thing and understand what it was saying, but I didn't really understand music as a language. So like I couldn't really play by ear. I could learn a piece and memorize it, play it without, but I couldn't, you know, there was a certain kind of logic that I didn't have. But one of the things that I did find out a little bit later on was that I have the ability to hear language as music. And so obviously, you know, for a person, you know, that's a phenomenal gift. That's not something that I can take credit for. And so there's certain kinds of things I can do. Like, for example, I told you, I like to listen to the poems of Rumi in Farsi, because I, even though, you know, it's language, like I can hear it in music, and oftentimes I can hear forms. Like if I listen to a ghazal in Urdu, even though I don't understand the words, I can hear the form. You know, I can hear the kadif, I can hear the radif. If I listen to a poem in Lithuanian, for example, and it's, you know, in rhyming couplets or it's in quatrains or whatever, I can actually, you know, hear the form. So there's a fair amount of poets, like, for example, I love listening to Pushkin in Russian.
Well, that says it all, that you have explained a lot, along with a simple 4 one-syllable words, I love to learn. I love to learn. Let us have a closing poem.
Okay. I'll finish up with this poem, since I talked about playing the trumpet. This poem is called An Idea of Improvisation with the Eye in Paradox. Once, oh no, I'm sorry, let me start with the ghost poem. An imaginary evergreen. Oh no, here we go. Mistranslation, the seeds of an imaginary evergreen. Okay, this is an idea of improvisation with the I Am paradox. Once, Pythagoras, my purple plush toy, hummed joyful sounds only I could hear until metal teeth on the sprocket of logic severed his single horn. Newly numb and seeking to sew together his song, I took up the trumpet. Assuming no mistranslation, didn't Pythagoras praise music as sacred math, numbers raised to the highest power? Here, I could note how the throats of birds tend to angle when raising the seeds of melody in their beaks. Was this how my school trumpet angled to be muted as moonlight fluttered our shoebox apartment and I practiced what beauty was allowed? I believe Pythagoras could have allowed for the I in lyric a sign of an imaginary unit. Perhaps the bird part of our brains cosigned the seeds of language by angling our tangents towards evergreen musing about music. Can't the need inside a pine or phonograph needle equally sow air into sense of song? Have you ever smelled oil in the breath of a trumpet or felt rhythm uncoil to kill time around midnight? Logicians try to prove that death has many fugues, though little logic, since death was once branded with the fugitive logo of the fleur de lis. I swear, my boy T claims this may be the truest thing about beauty. A lyric can be a useful essay, but an essay is a useless-ass lyric. When I play the lyre, I claim to see lyrics collecting on lips as dew collects on dogwood leaves. But do I? Maybe I only took up the horn to learn how to hold Apophenia and collect her breath in the bowl of my collarbone. After an errant elbow freed some teeth, I tried to pick up the horn again. But red graffiti scrawled in the school bathroom stall claimed a one-armed man could never play the violin. What trumpeter's mouth isn't an unread wound? Have you heard how Lee Morgan could read sheet music easily as his beloved's grocery notes, but still misread her most notable longing? There's some nights I think Pythagoras merely saw music as the grammar of sound making sentences. But listen, who among us hasn't needed to number the hoarse notes galloping out of a bridled mouth?
Mouth as an unread wound, the voice of Joel Diaz Porter, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. Our program is produced by Forest Woods Media Production, post-production by Mike Turpin, MAT Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by Sandy Jackson Cohen, the Sinipid Fund, and the Anne Arundel Arts Council. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and our engineer is Mike Turpin.